This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia, the podcast where we visit with authors about information located beyond the pages of their books. This episode features a conversation I had recently with Carol Birch. Birch is skilled at crafting fiction around historical fact, especially when there's not enough factual information available. That was the case with her latest book, Orphans of the Carnival. The novel looks at the life of Julia Pastrana. Born in Mexico in the 1930s, she could sing and dance, was fluent in several languages, and was billed as the ugliest woman in the world. It's fiction based on fact, and against a backdrop of carnivals and freak shows, the story is stranger than fiction.
It sounds as if you couldn't make it up. You know, it doesn't sound true, but it is true. And I was kind of struck by how sad the whole thing was. It stuck in my mind for many, many reasons. And I think largely it was because I felt very moved by Julia, but I also felt very moved by her baby. And that was one of the motivating factors to make me write the book, I think. I was thinking about her and her baby and how she has been remembered to a large extent, but her baby's been forgotten largely, and I felt very sad about that.
And you brought the fate of the baby, you know, to a bit of a closure in the book, but do we know what happened to the baby in her life?
We don't. That's complete fiction. Okay. We don't know. The last that was known of the baby was he was discovered with his mother in the warehouse, as it happens in the book. And she was then taken, being a kind of a medical curiosity, they called her. She was taken to the museum in the part of the university. And the baby was badly damaged by having been nibbled at by rats and so on. So he was just thrown away with the rubbish, as far as we know. And nobody really knows what became of that baby. It probably just went into a landfill. But I felt that was a terribly sad thing to happen to human remains, and I kept thinking about that. It kept going through my head, so I wanted to kind of give that baby a kind of fictional closure, I suppose.
And how much research was available to you about Julia? I was reading that you got your idea from a book at a secondhand bookshop, and you had seen her picture in your teens,
yes,
and it stuck in your mind.
That's right, yes. And then I saw a book about her, so I read it. there is quite a bit, but there's huge gaps in the knowledge there. There's very little known about the people surrounding her. So I have the names of her managers, for example, but I've made up their characters and so on. Her husband, I really did do a lot of trying to actually pin him down, which was very, very difficult, because the name Lent was known about in the carnival world, and there was another Lent who was more well-known and more successful. And I don't know if they were connected, but it seemed to me that they might very well have been. I couldn't find any proof for that in the research, but there's very little known about him, but little fragments and snatches here and there. And I just kind of made it up from there, basically. So quite a lot had been written about her by people who met her over the years when she was famous here in the States, in Europe and so on. Friederike, her friend, the German woman, the Austrian woman, she was a real woman, and she left memoirs and so on, memories of Julia. So there were memoirs which mentioned Julia, but Julia didn't speak for herself. She didn't leave anything at all in her own words.
Now, in the book, you have her leaving Mexico on her own accord, but is it true that she was actually sold in real life?
There's various different versions of this. It's basically take your pick. We know that she did actually live with the Sanchez family, that she was adopted into the household from an orphanage. As far as we know, that's true. There's the story about her being brought down from the mountains. I think there's no actual proof for that, but it tends to have been repeated many, many times. And that she lived with the Sanchez family as a kind of, like a servant in a way, part of the family, but she was basically a servant, and she was brought out to kind of, you know, to entertain people and so on. And that she left home at the age of 20 because she was very unsatisfied. Some people elaborated and say that she'd been treated cruelly and so on. I don't think there's any. I think a lot of it is just speculation. I don't think anybody really knows. It's to be made up by the writer or speculated upon by the historian.
She was very successful in this carnival world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was it because of the time? I mean, I also read that, you know, this Victorian age, people were fascinated by freak shows.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Are we still?
I think we still are, probably. I don't think things have changed as much as people. We're obviously more aware. We know more about why people are different. In her time, not very much was known about her conditions. For example, a very good doctor, one of the top doctors in New York, actually stated that she was hybrid, half human, part something else, which seems ridiculous, of course. But if a clever man at the height of the medical profession was saying things like that seriously at that time, it meant that there was a huge question in people's minds. People were fascinated by the world out there and the people coming in. It was the time when they were sort of, the world was opening out, I suppose. They were becoming aware of people from all over the place and differences. And it was a kind of free for all, really. And I think there was some horrendous abuses that went on as well. I think it was also before anybody really understood what to do, how to handle their unease and so on. And it pulled them in. You know, millions of people went to the freak shows. And I think we can easily stereotype them and say it was a very cruel thing. And in many cases it was, but I don't think you can judge the whole thing like that. It was a different time, a different way of looking at things. And I think we can't afford to stereotype the kind of people who went to these shows, the kind of people who handled them. They were people, all kinds. There were good ones and bad ones, I believe. There were the ones who exploited, and there were the ones who had a great relationship with their, what do you want to call them, their charge, their property. Sometimes, in some cases, they had actually been sold to them. It was a very strange world that it's very hard to put your head into nowadays.
And she was treated in a couple of different ways. I mean, some were, they would clamor to see her dance and sing and perform, and then yeah, she was ridiculed by others.
Yes, I think that they probably all got that, I think. As I was saying, there's no one type of person who went. I think you've got the people who went to be horrified. You've got the people who went to have a good laugh. You've got the people who went because they were just curious and so on. And some had good intentions and some didn't. And she got the full lot. She got the full gamut. I think she became very skilled at dealing with it. I think a lot of them did, actually. A lot of them seem to have had a certain way of knowing how to work a crowd. They became very, very adept and very wise at that sort of thing, and how to deal with people, how to meet people's stare and so on. It was a kind of way of life and a livelihood for many people. And some of them could turn it into something in their favour, and others, I think, it damaged very badly. It's different in different cases.
Do you think she had control over her own contracts like she did in the book?
I don't know about that. I have no idea. I do know that she was an intelligent woman, and I do know that she gave money to charity and made some decisions for herself like that, but she also didn't want to be bothered with money, apparently, so it's been said. So I really am not sure about what the reality of all that was. I kind of have her having a little bit of say about it all and, you know, being coached by the other girls and so on. Because some people were undoubtedly exploited, and she was a good-natured girl who, I think, wasn't interested in that side of things, so she could have easily been exploited, but I don't know. I'm just making it up as I go along, basically. I'm doing what comes through to me, what my impressions are that come through when I read about her and hear about her and so on. It may not be right. What's come out of it is my Julia. I'm not claiming that that is the historical Julia. I don't think we'll ever know that. And people have portrayed her in other ways.
Okay, let's talk about your Julia.
My Julia, yes.
She was very capable. She was somewhat lonely because she was never really allowed to venture off on her own. She traveled for how many years and only really saw the insides of carriages and coach cars and hotel rooms, and she read a lot, but she wanted to know if she would ever be loved.
Yes, again, I mean, this is this kind of apocryphal stories told of Julia. One is that on her deathbed, she said to somebody that she was going to die happy because she knew that she'd been loved for who she really was. I mean, I think that sounds all a little bit too contrived somehow to be true. But she did, by all accounts, from people who spoke to her, Friederike, I think, said something about this and other people, that she did seem to have really believed that her marriage was genuine. And people seem to have had a very hard time believing that, other people. But whether on his part it was a genuine marriage or not, he seems to have done a very good job at convincing her that it was.
And, you know, I mean, part of me wants to know if Lent married her just to keep her from moving on, but we don't know.
Well, I did what I could with that in the book, and I think both things may have applied, and I think it was more complicated than simply he was this villain who wanted to his meal ticket, which is the way he's been portrayed as a total villain usually. And I can see why, absolutely, and he did some terrible, inexcusable things. At the same time, I think the whole thing came across as a little more ambiguous than that when I was researching the little there was on him. He, first of all, the fact that she seems to have trusted him and had faith in him, and the fact that his second wife, who was also a hairy lady, and you can make what you want of that, you know, obviously he had a business interest in these women, but that she also apparently, I came across a thing where she was talking to people after his death, and she had very fond memories. She remembered him as a good man and so on. So I think there was more to the story. There was also the fact that in his later life, thinking on what he did drove him mad, basically, and he couldn't live with it. So there was more to him than that, I think. That was my impression. But again, it's all made up, you know, so it would have been very boring to write about just heroes and villains, I think. So I think that was an ambiguous relationship.
Well, I think this is one instance where I'm glad I didn't realize that this was based on nonfiction when I first started reading it, because I didn't realize he had been villainized, and I enjoyed him. I liked him as a character. I mean, and even at the end, when you know, when the doctor was approaching him for the baby and for her body, and he was saying no, not now, not now, not now. I mean, I felt he was truly bothered and not thinking ahead to how to yes. monetize it.
Yes, I don't know. It's hard to imagine why somebody does what he did, which sounds on the surface terrible. But that was partly why I tried to kind of explain his character as somebody who could he was a modern man who accepted the materialist view of the world, so and so on. As he tries to make the point during the book, you know, it's like carrying a lock of hair or something. It's just the same thing written large. I think he justified things to himself in his own way, but he couldn't actually live with the whole thing, perhaps, because he didn't have a stable end to his life. It's a sad story, I think, but in a funny sort of way, I think, in a funny sort of way, he's almost more of a tragic character than she is, because we all love Julia. Julia's the one we know, and she survived in her own way. We remember Julia, and everybody who gets to know Julia through reading or whatever ends up loving Julia. Now, in a way, there's more of a tragedy in his character because he has been the villain. And I don't think he was a complete villain. I think he was a very flawed, very unstable man. And I think he did some very bad things. But that's perhaps... nobody remembers him fondly. And that's kind of sad, really. Apart from his ex-wife. So that says something, maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I love that this is just it's another look. It's another idea.
Yeah. Well, this is it. It's just playing with the ideas of how things might have been. Nobody actually knows, of course. But somebody out there may have information that I didn't come across that would be really thrilling if they have. I'd love to hear it, if somebody knew these people for real and has some kind of story about it that could cast more light. It'd be wonderful.
Now, Julia had, did she have two rare conditions that affected?
She'd had hypertrichosis, which is the one where you have hair all over. The other one, I don't know the name of it actually to pronounce. It's something that affects the jaw. She had a condition of the jaw and the gums. She had gum disease, which sort of meant that all the material down there, the bony stuff, overgrew. So she looked as if she had this great protruding jaw, and it looked as if she had a double set of teeth and so on. It was actually overgrown gum. So this added to the ape-like effect, which made her look not just like the ordinary bearded lady or the ordinary hairy-faced lady, but altogether more simian, and which was why she had, you know, more of an image, really. She really did look more inhuman, I suppose. You know, you could understand the kind of what was going through their minds, the people who were packaging her, the ape woman, the bear woman, you know, all this kind of thing. She was a strange-looking woman. There was no getting away from it. With that, she did absolutely the most she could. And she made herself into a kind of beauty of her own kind, which was, I think, absolutely marvellous. A lot of people like to have her picture on the wall now. You know, you find that the image of her, that iconic image, it's, you see it around a lot. It's she's become accepted.
I'm looking at it right now.
You're looking at her right now. Mm-hmm. She doesn't look ugly, does she, anymore?
No, not at all.
She looks rather beautiful in some ways, I think. You know, and people have accepted Julia now. I think she's, and she always will be, I think. She's become quite an icon.
And her son had the same conditions?
He had the same condition, yes. He was born with the same condition. I don't think he had the jaw condition, no, just the hair.
Okay.
As far as I know, he didn't live very long, poor little thing. You know, he wasn't with us very long. That's the sad part of the book.
Are there other people living in the world right now that have these same conditions? Are you aware of?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there are quite a lot of people with hypertrichosis still. I think there's, in Mexico, actually, I think there's a family that has the condition. There's a little girl in Indonesia. There's probably other people too. You know, it's rare, but it's not that rare. It's, you know, there are people with that condition, but people understand it more now. People know what it is. People accept them now. There have been TV programs about some of them, I think. You know, you get these things on the telly, don't you? You know, the girl with this, that and the other, and various other sorts of things. You know, people still are interested in looking, I suppose.
How do you think Julia would be treated today?
Today? I think Julia might do quite well, actually, today. I think with her character, with her skills, she had the fact that she... It wasn't just what she looked like. She did actually have musical skills. She did actually sing and dance and have musical training and so on. So I think she'd have done okay, actually, I think. I don't think she would have done too badly. Depending perhaps on her upbringing and so on, the confidence. But I think, you know, she had the confidence, Julia did. Something gave her that confidence. That's why I wanted her, in writing about her early life, something was there that gave her some kind of stability and confidence in order to do what she did. And that's why I put the character of Solana in. And I have no idea, but I do think that somewhere in that background, there was somebody who cared about her and gave her that confidence.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about this book? Anything you'd like for readers to take away?
One of the things that was going through my mind in this was the kind of meanings that we give to objects, you know, to the physical world, to the material world, because it kind of seemed, the more I was writing it, that a lot of the attitudes to what became of Julia and to people's attitudes to Theo Lent were to do with how we feel about physical remains, human remains and so on. And I got really interested in that. Now, here we are, like, you know, we live in these very modern material times, and a lot of people don't believe in the soul and so on. And yet the object, the physical remains of a human, we still all feel. For example, we all feel revulsion if we hear about a cemetery being desecrated or something, or somebody's remains being tampered with and so on. And it was just that whole idea that got me thinking about this, and which led me into the whole thing of what the way we invest emotion into objects, and they become things in their own right, like children's dolls and so on. And so there is also that side to it, which I think is, it's intrinsic. I mean, that had to be there because the story of Julia didn't just finish when her life ended. It went on. And that's why the story of the baby had to be there. And that's why there had to be a modern dimension, I think. I do think that's part of the book, is what we feel emotionally about the objects in our lives as well, whether they become powerful in some way because of the emotions that we put into them.
That was Carol Birch, author of Orphans of the Carnival, which was published by Doubleday. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.